The headlines: the U.S. keeps sending more troops to Europe amid simmering tensions between the West and Russia over Ukraine. Iran's top security official says no deal will ever stop the country from maintaining and developing its peaceful nuclear program. Plus, the parents of a 22-year-old African-American man fatally shot by Minneapolis police say that their son was executed by the police. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. is deploying additional troops to Europe as a standoff between the West and Russia intensifies over Ukraine. The first batch of American soldiers landed in Poland shortly after the arrival of senior U.S. commanders. Polish Army spokesman says the bulk of a contingent of 1,700 U.S. soldiers will come soon. President Biden is sending nearly 3,000 extra troops to Poland and Romania. Washington says that the move is aimed at shielding Eastern Europe in the face of a potential spillover from the Ukraine crisis. U.S. and its allies accuse Russia of amassing over 100,000 troops on the borders of Ukraine, preparation for an invasion. Moscow denies that and is strongly opposed to increased military activity by the U.S. and NATO near its borders. Tensions remain high between Russia and the West over Ukraine, despite talks held in previous weeks to defuse them. The U.S. and its NATO allies insist that Russia plans to invade Ukraine and is providing pretext for that. Russia denies any such plan and instead complains about increased military activity by NATO near its borders. Even Ukraine has called on the West not to create panic. So why is the West keeping its stance?
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a U.S. ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the U.S. continues to fan the flames of tensions. Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
The U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used a false flag there. Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam, the incubator babies in 1990 that started, you know, was enabled the first war in Iraq, the WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003, in Libya, the invisible airplanes, apparently Russian satellites just couldn't see them, that were supposedly strafing protesters, that, by the way, no one had any video of, in Benghazi and Tripoli, that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time. Russia, there's no example of that that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, short answer to this is it's called misdirection. Or projection, as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate a pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded.
Since taking office in January of last year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has exerted pressure on Russia and China. It has imposed rounds of sanctions on both countries for various issues. The result, the two eastern superpowers inching closer. They promised to boost cooperation, including on plans to use their national currencies in trade instead of using the U.S. dollar.
China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that their reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon, but the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions dubbed the Cold War that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Iran's top security official says real, effective, and verifiable economic benefits for Iran is a necessary condition to reach an agreement in Vienna. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani says making a pretense of lifting sanctions is not considered to be constructive. He also says that Iran has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities. His comments came as Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal are engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the accord. The deal was put in limbo after the U.S. left it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. On Friday, Washington restored a number of sanctions waivers, saying the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. Iran has time and again said that the Vienna talks should result in the full removal of sanctions. What happens on paper is good, but not enough. That is how the Iranian foreign minister characterizes the U.S. announcement of sanctions waiver for Iran. Hossein Amir Abdollahian says that Washington must show its goodwill in action, and that means palpable developments on the ground. He confirmed that the removal of sanctions can be a reflection of the U.S. goodwill. Amir Abdollahian pointed to the ongoing talks and said that agreements have been reached in some areas. The top Iranian diplomat added that one of the main goals of the Vienna talks is obtaining necessary guarantees, particularly from the Western side, for the implementation of their commitments. Amir Abdollahian stressed that Tehran demands guarantees in political, legal, and economic sectors. The International Atomic Energy Agency sees signs of optimism over the ongoing Vienna talks. The IAEA believes negotiations are moving on the right path, despite challenges. The IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, says the agency will do all that it can to support reaching an agreement and ensuring the implementation and adherence to it. He noted that reaching an agreement in a matter of days is a difficult and complicated thing, but not impossible. Grossi also warned that there would be no agreement without the cooperation and commitment of all parties. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are currently engaged in talks in the Austrian capital. The main focus is to remove anti-Iran sanctions and to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Archbishop of Mount Lebanon and Tripoli, Mor Theophilus George Salipa, has hailed Iran's stance on Palestine. The Archbishop says Iran's support of Palestinians include turning over the Israeli embassy in Tehran to the Palestinian people after the 1979 revolution is admirable. He said the goal of Islamic revolution in Iran was to back the oppressed, which is why it continues to support resistance movements in Palestine. The U.S. administration has changed hands between Democrats and Republicans since the outbreak of a Saudi-led war in Yemen in 2015. But no matter which government holds the reins, the U.S. sticks to the same policies. 7 years on, the U.S. continues to provide coalition states with unwavering military and diplomatic support, making itself complicit in Yemen's war crimes. In the following report, we will review how three U.S. administrations missed their chances to end one of the world's bloodiest wars.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the U.N. says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
The mother of an African-American man killed by the U.S. police during a raid on his apartment has called for the officer at fault to be prosecuted.
At the end of the day, I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Mark's parents described their son as a talented musician, the beloved mother, or member of his community, and a law-abiding citizen. The incident occurred in the early hours of Wednesday. Footage released by the police shows an officer using a key to unlock the door, and then a group of officers enter while shouting police search warrant. Locke, who was on a couch, starts to rise from beneath a blanket with a gun in his hand when police fire. The total time between the officer's entrance and the shots fired was less than 10 seconds. The attorney of the Locke family has slammed the police conduct and said that they gave the victim no chance.
They barge in before they ever identify themselves, and they give Amir no time to save his own life. And that's something that we don't see white citizens encounter. And the fact that it's happening in Minneapolis again is beyond tragic.
According to the family's lawyers, Locke had no criminal history and legally possessed a firearm at the time of his death. He was not named in the police search warrant, which was issued in relation to a homicide investigation. The Minneapolis mayor has announced a moratorium on no-knock warrants following the incident. A no-knock warrant authorizes police officers to enter a property without first knocking and announcing their presence. The investigation is launched into the killing. The incident is the latest to put the Minneapolis Police Department under scrutiny. Almost 2 years ago, George Floyd, an unarmed black man, was killed by a white officer who knelt on his neck for over 9 minutes during an arrest. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The variants rapid spread, different vaccine strategies, and varying levels of immunity worldwide make the pandemic's future difficult to model, says David Adam, writer, in an article published under the heading, Will Omicron End the Pandemic? Here's what experts say. Stay tuned for more. On January 11th, just 7 weeks after the Omicron variant was first reported, the World Health Organization, WHO, warned of a tidal wave of infection washing from west to east across the world. 50 of the 53 countries in Europe and Central Asia had reported cases of Omicron, said Hans-Henry Klug, the WHO's regional director for Europe. Countries would have to cope as best they could, he said, guided by their individual epidemiological situation, available resources, vaccination uptake status, and socioeconomic context. In recent weeks, countries in Europe and the United States have felt the full force of Omicron wave. In the UK, which has reported most infections, daily COVID-19 cases peaked at more than 160,000 earlier this month. Scientists there say all nations are facing the same major problem: the sheer speed at which the variant spreads. And although the WHO and others have suggested that huge numbers of Omicron infections could signal the end of the pandemic because of the short-term surge in immunity that will follow, researchers warn that the situation remains volatile and difficult to model. It moves so fast that it gives very little time to prepare any kind of response, so decisions have to be made under huge uncertainty, says Graham Medley, an infectious diseases modeler at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who advises the UK government. Numbers of Omicron infections can double in less than 2 days, which is significantly faster than previous SARS-CoV-2 variants and closer to what public health officials would expect from the milder influenza virus. One scientist says Omicron is flu on acid. We haven't seen that speed before, and it meant you couldn't vax your way out of it, adds Christina Pagel, a healthcare data analyst at University College London, adding, even if you could vax everybody, it still takes 2 weeks for the vaccine to kick in, and by then you are in the middle of it. That places policymakers and researchers who advise them in an unenviable position. It was a situation where you either put it in restrictions very, very early or you do nothing, Pagel says, adding, but if you wait to see what happens, then it's too late. Along with other countries, Britain tightened regulations in December, but it was a controversial move, particularly because reports from South Africa, which was hit by Omicron the previous month, suggested that the variant seemed to cause less severe illness and hospitalization, a conclusion now supported by the experience of the UK and other places. UK modelers were initially torn about how to use information from South Africa. It's relatively straightforward to update a computer model to account for changes in the biological properties of a new variant. However, as the pandemic has progressed, it has become much harder to simulate the baseline immune response of a country's population and so to judge how that will limit spread. In the early days of the pandemic, researchers could assume that most people worldwide were equally susceptible to infection because COVID-19 was a new disease and no vaccines were available. But 12 months of different vaccine strategies, types, and take-up rates from country to country, as well as fluctuating rates of infection and recovery, have left a diverse immunological landscape. The probability that infection will put someone in hospital is absolutely a key parameter, but we are now estimating that in an obviously not naive population, says Mark Woolhouse, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Edinburgh, UK, who also advises the government, adding, when you are making those sorts of estimates, formally you really should remake them for every population you're interested in, and that applies everywhere. Modelers were confounded by the lack of specifics in South African data about reduced severity. There was no quantitative analysis, Woolhouse says, adding, so what numbers do you plug in? Are you saying 10% less pathogenic, or 50% less, or 90% less? Still speaking in a personal capacity, Woolhouse says that some influential modelers in the UK were wrong not to allow for any reduced severity, instead working with assumed hospitalization rates for Omicron that were identical to those of previous variants. That's clearly a pessimistic assumption, he says, adding, I do not think it could have been much clearer from the beginning that there was this possibility it was less pathogenic, and you know, being crystal clear on what the policy implications of that difference might be. the heterogeneity in immunological baselines and other important factors such as population dynamics from country to country make it difficult to predict international spread of Omicron with any precision or to assess, for example, how the variant might take hold in countries with lower vaccination rates. It's very hard to answer that question, says Julian Tang, a consultant virologist at the Leicester Royal Infirmary, UK. And it's not very useful because if you say it's spreading in pattern X, Y, Z across Western Europe and then A, B, C across North America and M and O in Africa, that doesn't really help anybody. The waning protection against infection that vaccines offer against Omicron also complicates the picture. Lab studies have indicated that inactivated virus vaccines, which make up almost half of the 10 billion doses distributed worldwide, elicit few antibodies against the variant. Does that mean that Omicron will rip through places that rely on these shots even faster? Not necessarily, says Woolhouse. The inactivated virus vaccines might induce a broader immunity that would react to a wider range of strains because it will elicit immune responses against viral proteins other than spike, which is particularly variable, he says. It's a very interesting question, but I simply haven't seen a formal analysis of it yet. That's because there are few real-world data to go on. It's only just hitting countries that have used them, says Pagel. Among the countries that rely on inactivated virus vaccines, Omicron seems to be making the most headway in the Philippines, which saw an exponential rise in COVID-19 cases this month, particularly in Manila. The number of new infections in the capital does not seem to be dropping, but the virus is spreading farther afield. Definitely cases are slowing down in the national capital region, but in other regions it is now increasing, said Maria Rosario Veregui, health spokesperson for the Philippines government. Vaccination rates are still relatively low in the Philippines, with 53% of the population fully vaccinated. Officials dare say they want to vaccinate all the country's 77 million adults by May. Although vaccines are likely to continue protecting against severe symptoms, Pagel says, infection will continue to spread, adding, I think the assumption is that none of the vaccines are going to give you long-lasting protection against infection. Tang agrees, saying, I don't think vaccines are the way this pandemic is going to end. So how will it end? Not with Omicron, researchers predict. This will not be the last variant, and so the next variant will have its own characteristics, Medley says. Given that the virus is unlikely to disappear completely, COVID-19 will inevitably become an endemic disease, scientists say. But that's a slippery concept, and one that means different things to different people. I think it's the expectation that the general behavior is somehow towards the situation where we have so much immunity in the population that we would no longer see very deadly epidemics, says Sebastian Funk, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The transition to endemicity, or living with the virus without restrictions and safeguards, is difficult to model with any accuracy, he adds. That's partly because even the best disease models struggle to make sensible forecasts beyond a few weeks ahead. It's also because endemicity reflects a judgment call on how many deaths societies are willing to tolerate while the global population steadily builds up immunity. For Woolhouse, COVID-19 will truly become endemic only when more adults are protected against severe infection because they have been exposed multiple times to the virus as children and so have developed natural immunity. That will take decades, and it means many older people today who were not exposed as children will remain vulnerable and might need continued vaccinations. That strategy has its flaws. Some of those exposed as children will develop long COVID, and it relies on children continuing to show much lower rates of severe illness as variants evolve. There are no guarantees that the next variant will be milder, but Tang says that seems to be the pattern so far. He says this virus is getting milder and milder with each iteration.
Africa Today.
Several African countries have been forced to discard millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccines donated or actually dumped by major Western powers because the vaccines expired within weeks of being received as donations. Last December, Nigeria had no option but to destroy more than 1 million doses of expired AstraZeneca vaccines. A senior official speaks here on the expired vaccines. Let's take a listen.
In an environment where, despite the interest, despite concerted effort by the federal government to procure these vaccines were not available in the open market a few months ago because they had largely been mopped up by the wealthier nations.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and as always, it's always great welcoming you here at Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. In the first segment of our program, we are focusing on how Western countries stockpile excess vaccines and donate them to African countries when they are about to expire. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about Djibouti, a tiny but strategic Horn of Africa state that has been turned into a hub of imperialist powers seeking to spread the hegemony all over Africa and beyond. Stay with us until the end of our show.
Expired COVID-19 vaccines in Africa. Several African countries, including Nigeria, Uganda, and Malawi, have been forced to destroy millions of doses of expired COVID-19 vaccines that were donated by Western countries. This scandal comes at a time when many countries on the African continent are facing vaccine nationalism and apartheid from the West.
In response to this dumping of expired vaccines, Dr. John Nkengasong, director of Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, recently called for donated COVID-19 vaccines to come with a shelf life of 3 to 6 months. He says this will enable countries plan their rollouts and avoid a situation where doses expire. He noted that African countries are now refusing donated vaccines that are about to expire.
Some certain countries are actually refusing totally to accept the vaccines because of exactly that. If they see that the shelf life that of the given vaccine is only 1 month or 2 months, they prefer not to receive those vaccines because it will create a narrative that vaccines have expired in their countries. I think most countries are very sensitive to that now.
Now, to discuss this dumping of vaccines in Africa by Western countries, we contacted Dr. Catherine Chabutungi, an epidemiologist and the executive director of African Population and Health Research Center. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, several African countries have been forced to discard millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccines donated by major Western powers because they expired within weeks of being received as donations. Now, what's your take on this?
The African systems for delivering the COVID vaccine have not evolved, you know, in the last 12 months, if I could say, from early 2021. The systems have not evolved because supply has been erratic, it has been unpredictable, and so it is inevitable that when you have millions of doses being dumped on the continent in the last 2 months of the year, you know, that it is inevitable that those doses cannot be absorbed in the time frame they're supposed to be absorbed in. If these were doses which perhaps are going to expire after 7 months or after 9 months, that wouldn't be a problem. But dumping millions of doses on a system which has not been set up to absorb those doses at the time of the year when there's so much disruption because of the Christmas break, I think it was inevitable. That's what I would say, and that's what I said, that it was inevitable. And it's such a shame that we are in a situation where few doses of vaccines are being wasted just because of the way the whole global supply system is set up.
This dumping of about to expire vaccines is regrettable, especially as Africa remains the least vaccinated continent against COVID-19. The move to dump vaccines in Africa is not only immoral, but also a violation of basic human rights. Experts say such behavior by the West is the weakest link in the fight against COVID-19. In a bid to stop this dumping, Kenya now says it will not accept vaccines with a shelf life of below 3 months.
We will not accept any donation whose expiry is less than 90 days. We are ideally looking for 120 days, which is 4 months, but will not accept anything below 90 days.
Why are Western countries engaging in what is clearly political showmanship of donating vaccines which are about to expire?
Western countries have always done that. It's just that COVID-19 is in the public eye because there's so much media coverage and everybody's invested in understanding what is going on in a system that has always existed that way. So I think to look at this, you have to put yourself in the shoes of Western countries, that if you're a Western country leader, you're a politician.
The COVID-19 Vaccine Procurement Facility, led by the African Vaccine Procurement Trust, the African Center for Diseases Control and Prevention, and the WHO, are calling for improvements in the quality of vaccines donated to Africa. Now, Dr. Chuktungi, how can these be achieved?
Now, what should be done to change course? Going back to my earlier point, I think you have to think about the long-term things, the medium-term things, and the short-term things. Now, the long-term, of course, is the, how do we shift this whole broken system of global health where there's such power imbalance, there's such, overwhelming influence by some countries over global health practice. And then what you called putting profits before people. Those are political choices that the residents and the populations in those Western countries have to make, where, for instance, they could, make political choices that favor politicians and governments and parties that put humanity above, profit. That's a much more long-term thing because it has to happen in more countries and, so that at least at the end of the day, the world, has a sort of a reset of its values.
Now, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says, in order to tackle the current situation, developing countries need to manufacture their own vaccines. He made the remarks in January when he opened a new vaccine plant in Cape Town. Let's take a listen.
Africa should no longer go cap in hand to the Western world, begging and begging for vaccines that they just want to drip off from their tables. We will stand on our own.
Dr. Chuktungi, now what are the obstacles towards the manufacture of vaccines in Africa?
And yet the benefit extends beyond the individual. So vaccines traditionally have been funded or financed as public goods, where globally there have been mechanisms which have been put in place to ensure that everybody everywhere can receive vaccines without having to think about the cost of those vaccines. And so when you have this kind of mechanism, it is not profitable for pharmaceutical companies to produce vaccines, because if they produce them and they're going to market them and sell them the way they sell everything else, the market wouldn't exist. And so the system has been set up in such a way that vaccines, being global public goods, they are financed in a very specific model, and therefore Africa, without having already existing infrastructure before these funding models are put in place, wouldn't be competitive on the global market for producing vaccines and selling them. So there have been no prior investments in mass manufactured vaccines in Africa. But what the pandemic has shown us is that Africa is dispensable. African lives are dispensable. When push comes to shove, when every country is facing a pandemic, an outbreak within their borders, they prioritize their citizens. And so Africa, which has traditionally not had capacity, is the last on the list of priorities.
Iran is now a major manufacturer of COVID-19 vaccines. The Islamic Republic has developed vaccines such as Coviran Barakat and Pastu Covac, which are now being used in the country's national vaccination drive. The Pastu Covac vaccine has been successfully produced jointly by Iran and Cuba. Iran has expressed readiness to share its vaccine technology with other African and developing countries, which will certainly lead to self-sufficiency in vaccine production.
Historically, we know about some Western pharmaceutical companies such as Pfizer that used Africa to undertake illegal or unethical trial of drugs. Some African countries participated in the COVID-19 vaccine trials, but unfortunately, they were not prioritized in the on-time distribution of vaccines. Now, Dr. Choptungi, what is being done to decolonize the global health system?
The environment has improved, and the regulatory environment has improved for research. And so the narrative around guinea pigs, once in a while you get the occasional unethical practice, but it's not as prevalent as it was a few years ago. Now, having said that, I think the question is, based on what we know and our experience, for instance, with HIV/AIDS therapeutics, what kind of negotiations the countries which had vaccine trials happening within their borders, what kind of negotiations they had, and whether there was any special considerations to be sure that they get a certain allocation of vaccine doses once the trials were concluded. I'm not privy to that. And by all indications, those countries don't seem to be advantaged compared to other countries. And so it's possible that in spite of all the investment in strengthening the system, that still this was something that countries missed out in when they were negotiating or when they were accepting to have their populations participate in this vaccine trial.
We are apparently short of time, but thanks a lot, Dr. Catherine Choptungi, for your insight. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall see how Djibouti has become a hub of imperialist aggression in Africa. Stay with us. Djibouti is a tiny Horn of Africa country located at the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb, which links the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden. Now, this country is considered of vital strategic importance, but despite its location, Djibouti remains poor and is now being used as a hub of United States-led imperialist powers that seek to spread their hegemony in Africa and beyond.
Successive regimes in Djibouti have clung to power by promoting their small country in the Horn of Africa as a vital tool for Western powers to use in the quest for their global dominance. While neo-colonial Western powers use Djibouti only as a military base, the country is benefiting from China's Belt and Road Initiative, a global infrastructure development strategy. The U.S. is now intent on misusing its presence in Djibouti to counter China, which established a military base in the country to safeguard world peace and development.
When I visited China for training in 2009-2010, there was a very big change because all areas of the military had been computerized and you had advanced technologies in terms of satellite, in terms of computers, in terms of nuclear forces, which are purely defensive.
For analysis on how Djibouti is being misused by Western powers as a center of imperialist aggression, we contacted Abdurrahman Mohammed Ahmed, a Djiboutian political activist living in exile. Thanks a lot for your time, Sam.
Thank you.
Now, how did Djibouti turn into a major base of U.S. militarization and imperialism in Africa?
We can say that actually the decision was not an idea that came from Djibouti or the political leaders of Djibouti at that moment, but it was always a long vision from the U.S. and especially the Western imperialist in camp to have this idea of controlling major maritime road. So after the September 11, there has been a negotiation, and we know with fact today that discussion was facilitated by another vassal regime of U.S. imperialism, namely the Emirates, under the guise of actually helping Djibouti to develop its economy. So after September 11, that's when the the U.S. decided to have a military base in Djibouti.
Last November, Djibouti hosted the U.S.-led Allied Appreciation Day, in which major U.S. allies, including Britain and France, showcased a variety of equipment that is part of their military operation. Military officials presented a variety of military capabilities and a military flyover. What was the motivation of Djibouti in approving such an event that could be viewed as a threat to China, which has a base in the country?
Djibouti became actually lost its sovereignty, so they accept silently any dictate for other benefits, such as actually kind of money, or actually by keeping that dictatorial regime in the loop of the Western countries. But for me, when they showcased their equipment, it was a message directed first of all to the rest of the African country, because today we know that they are losing their credibility, or what's left about their credibility. So they are still trying to say, we still have the best equipment and we are the best to defend you, which is not true.
By allowing aggressive military moves by Western armies on its soil, Djibouti could be turning itself into a power keg.
In 2018, there were military tensions between the United States and China in Djibouti. Now, in a provocative move, Pentagon claimed the Chinese lasers injured U.S. military pilots in Djibouti. China refuted the allegations, saying it was in complete contradiction to the facts.
I can tell you the Chinese side, having conducted serious checks, has already clearly told the U.S. side that their so-called criticisms totally do not accord with the facts.
Now, Mr. Ahmad, is there a likelihood of a military confrontation between China and the United States in Djibouti?
Yes, the possibility is very high. Already what we are witnessing is actually a kind of a Cold War confrontation. On another side, they're trying to actually tarnish the image of China, especially when it comes to Djibouti, because China actually facilitated a lot of infrastructure projects, building the People Palace, building hospital, schools, stadium, roads.
The current Djibouti president, Ismail Omar Guelleh, has been in power for 22 years. April last year, he was re-elected for a fifth term as president with more than 98% of the vote after the election in a tiny country was boycotted by the main opposition. A citizen who spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal by the country's dictatorship gives his reasons for not voting. During the elections, Guelleh faced just one challenger, political newcomer Zakaria Ismail Farah. This sole opposition candidate cast doubt on the transparency of the voting process, saying his delegates were ejected from polling stations. The U.S. and other Western countries claim to advocate for democracy in the other African countries, but have ignored the dictatorship in Djibouti. This is another clear case of double standards.
Former president was more close to let's say the Western imperialism, and when he left power in 1999, he made sure that his nephew, the actual president, came to power. The actual president was at that moment not a political figure, but he made sure through a kind of a political coup to come to power. And since then, since 1999 up to today, it's more than actually 23 years, Ismail Omar Guelleh is still in power, and the Western allies are very happy with him and with his regime, because he's playing a crucial role for their interests, not only in Djibouti, but also in the region, and very specifically when it comes to Somalia.
Despite hosting Western military bases for decades, Djibouti is near the very bottom of the annual United Nations Human Development Index, ranking 166 out of 189. Now, Mr. Ahmad, what is the reason for this high level of poverty in Djibouti?
Past 44 years of independence, Djibouti today is worse than when we get the independence. And the reason is actually, when it comes to imperialism, what they want is actually always to put in place a puppet regime, a stooge regime, that will keep or protect their interests, and only these few people will get short benefits, while the majority of the people will get rip off from the their land and their own opportunities. So yes, I'm not surprised, and actually this is what's going on.
Can you elaborate a little bit on why these imperialist powers are interested in seeing poverty and destitution in Djibouti?
The imperialistic vision, it's actually to control physically and military, to control all these strategic location and not allow actually any awakening from the people. And we know also that actually people who are living there are Muslim, so they don't want actually any Muslim countries cooperating, defending their interests, coming back and developing their people, who even might become an example for other countries and other people. And what's happening in Djibouti, it is the perfect study case for many people, specifically for the Muslim community, because and thank you for this opportunity of especially this discussion with Press TV, because today when it comes to Djibouti or Somalia or other Muslim country, Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is demonized by the imperialist camp. But we know actually from our side that the Iranian people actually stood, refused to actually to be subjugated, and actually developed their country. But they don't want us to follow that example. They don't want us actually to tell that story. They're telling us a propaganda.
Well, thank you very much, Abdulrahman Muhammad Ahmad. It was a very interesting discussion, but unfortunately, our time is up for today. We shall definitely revisit the subject in future. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. And until our next episode, it's goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.